The Large Nerdron Collider podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Large Nerdron Collider podcast, the podcast that's all about the geeky things happening in the world around us and how very excited we are about them. I'm Ariel Kasten, and with me, as always, is Jonathan. He's going to be pretty upset at me for moving my pop filter right now, Strickland.
I am not the co-host you are looking for. You should go about your business.
You are not?
Move along. Hey, Ariel.
Okay, that was a short episode, guys. I'm sorry.
No. I'm just fooling. Hey, Ariel. I got a question for you. Okay, Ariel. So as always, it's more of a scenario than a question. But we're going to be talking about some stirwers today. Some wars in the stars, as it were. And so my question to you is that, so imagine you are a character, not a specific character, but like you inhabit the mythology of Star Wars. Would you be a Jedi, a smuggler, bounty hunter, something else? What kind of role do you envision yourself playing within Star Wars?
So, having played the Old Republic a whole bunch, I think I would probably be a smuggler. They cool. are the funnest. They, they're the dashing rogues of Star Wars. So, that is what I would be. Bounty hunters, they're either a little too evil for me, or they're a little too, like, if you look at Mando, he's a bit too upstanding. Jedis can be cool, but that whole, like, live in by a code thing, meh. What about you?
So I have a joke answer, which is that I'd want to be one of the band members at the Mos Eisley Cantina.
I mean, you didn't list that as an option, Jonathan.
I said, or something else. That includes, it's just like with every job description where it says other duties as assigned, right? It covers everything. I thought about that. Or maybe gambler, like Lando Calrissian is more of a gambler than a smuggler, which I think is kind of a fun. And I could be at least as good or bad of a gambler as Lando Calrissian seems to be. those are the kind of things that I was thinking of. Cause like, I agree with you, like Jedi was something I thought was super cool, but the further we get into the mythology, the more restrictive and sort of, twisted the Jedi seem to be. Like part of that is just because you have different people bringing their interpretations into Star Wars. Right. But
yeah,
we've had a lot of stories that explore the restrictive nature of the Jedi code and how that in many ways is not a good thing and that it doesn't benefit people very much. And so you then get like these crazy extremes. You got this very repressed, restrictive Jedi order. And then you have the uninhibited and self-destructive Sith. And there doesn't seem to be any middle ground. I know that some of the games have explored that, but like in the canon of what is officially Star Wars, there's not a whole lot that deals with that. So for that case, I'm going gambler, I think, because I think it's sort of along the same lines as smuggler. It's that sort of rakish, roguish kind of character that I find really appealing.
Yeah. Speaking of characters that are kind of more roguish, let's talk about our first news item.
Yeah, so the thing we wanted to chat about is an upcoming animated series that's going to play on Adult Swim, and it is Blade Runner. It's a new Blade Runner anime series, Blade Runner Black Lotus. And we learned a little bit about some of the voice actors who are going to be portraying characters in this. We don't know a whole lot about the specifics of the plot, but we know that the series is going to follow a character named Elle, who is a replicant. So that mystery is cleared up right away. We know
solved.
She's not going to have to take the test and figure out whether or not she'd help a turtle that was on its back. So L is a replicant who is created for a secret and unknown purpose, played by Jessica Henwick. We know that some interesting actors like Brian Cox is going to be voicing a character. When you hear Brian Cox, you're like, oh, clearly he's going to be one of those big businessy, you know, vaguely antagonistic characters. And sure enough, that's who he's playing, a Neander Wallace Sr. So Blade Runner, like if you're not familiar with Blade Runner, the world of Blade Runner, it's set in sort of a, it's an alternate future because the original Blade Runner was set, I think in 1999. Like it was
something like that.
Yeah. It's definitely in our past now, but it was this very super corporate, dystopian world. Not that different from what we have now, except we don't have flying cars and we don't have replicants. And you've got these replicants that are kind of like a mix between androids and a genetic creation that they purposefully live very short lifespans, and they're meant to do like manual dangerous labor, essentially the stuff that we make robots to do. But they have thoughts and feelings and often have implanted histories in their heads in the Blade Runner series so that they don't realize they're replicants.
So that might, it kind of sounds a little bit like Westworld. If you've watched Westworld, it's a similar kind of a theory. Mm-hmm. Although in Westworld, the replicants for the hosts are more thought to be more contained. Stephen Root is in it, and he's playing the chief of police. And I know that he plays a bunch of serious characters, but I always picture him from Office Space. And if he played the chief of police, like
Milton, the little mumbling character,
like Milton, it would not fit at all, I'm sure, in the story, but it would be hilarious, and I'd be all there for it.
Have you seen Buster Scruggs, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs?
Not yet. Okay. Like I watched like 5 minutes of it, but I need to sit and finish it.
He's in one of the vignettes in that. And it's another one of those, I mean, it's a Coen Brothers film, right? So and he's been in some Coen Brothers stuff. It's another, very quirky character, and like, and he plays in that one. He's a bank teller essentially in the Old West, but he does some gunslinging a little bit in that. And so I immediately went to that character, which again, would have not fit into the Blade Runner universe at all, but would be really entertaining.
It would be really entertaining. That being said, he's a very versatile actor.
Yes.
I think that's why some of his more quirky characters stick out to me, is just because he is so versatile.
He's phenomenal in Barry. He's absolutely amazing in that series.
Well, Barry is such a fun show, anyhow.
It's great. It's one of the best. Like, I didn't know I was going to enjoy it so much until I started watching it, and I thought, wow, this is a very dark but very funny show.
And it hits a little close to home at times for me as an actor. So.
Yeah, there's some actor stuff in it that it rings very true. But yes, this series looks like it's going to be really interesting. There's actually all the parts are most of the parts anyway, are double cast because they have a Japanese cast as well. I think one of the characters might be played by a single actor who might be fluent in both. But most of them are obviously played by two different actors who are providing either the English or the Japanese language versions of that. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it. We don't have details on when it's coming out. It just says that it's going to be airing on Adult Swim and also Crunchyroll later this year.
Yeah. It's not often that Adult Swim has something that really grabs me, but I think I will definitely take some time to check this one out. Something else that I'm going to take time to check out once we finally get it, regardless of what the details are on it, is the new series that Jemaine Clement and Taika Waititi are working on, which we have little to no details about other than it's going to be kind of action adventure-y comedy. And I love what they do. I love What We Do in the Shadows. Mm-hmm. And I guess we haven't gotten Wellington Paranormal yet.
No.
To watch that one as well.
Yeah. So of course, What We Do in the Shadows, in case you're not familiar, is it's done the documentary style, but follows the misadventures of vampires and sort of the the trials and tribulations they go through having a vampiric existence. And it's very silly. It's the movie is fantastic, and the series really expands upon it in a very fun way. So highly recommend those. But yeah, and of course, Taika Waititi, he's made a huge name for himself directing films in the MCU. You know, he did Thor Ragnarok. Yeah. He's doing Love and Thunder, the next Thor movie.
Yeah.
And
plus Jojo Rabbit, which was a phenomenal movie.
Jojo Rabbit. Yes. A difficult movie to sell to people when you tell them the premise, but yes, it is, is an amazing movie. And, Jemaine Clement, of course, obviously a brilliant comedian and musician as well. Part of Flight of the Conchords has done a huge amount of work that, a lot of it I think is underseen. There's a lot of stuff he's done that I don't think American audiences have really seen.
Well, he was in Legion. And he was a serious character in that, a bizarre but serious character, because everybody is bizarre in Legion, but just brilliant. I had only seen his comedy up to that point. But yeah, he's very multi-talented.
Yeah, it makes me sick. But we're going to get some sort of action adventure comedy. But as we say, there's not really any more detail about that. To me, when I hear action adventure comedy, my thoughts go back to some earlier shows. Like I was telling Ariel before the recording, it reminds me, I would describe Wizards and Warriors as, it was more of like a fantasy action comedy series, but it was the sort of thing that kind of later evolved into stuff like Hercules and Xena and the Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. And like these shows that did seem to try and pair comedy with action. It's to different degrees, right? Some of those series were less comedic than others, but they all had elements of comedy, sometimes like zany, like corny comedy.
And some of them were not intending to be quite as comedic as they were. I mean, look at Carl Urban playing Cupid and Xena. Like,
yeah,
they probably didn't mean for it to be quite as humorous as it was.
Yeah.
Especially now.
But it's interesting because I feel like this is a niche that really hasn't been filled. There are series out there. First of all, I don't think there's that many action adventure series out there. Everything's like procedurals and stuff, right? You don't get a lot of action adventure stuff anymore, at least not in TV. So that I'm really excited to see. Like, I want to kind of find out what their vision is for that sort of thing. I'm sure it's going to be hilarious, whatever it is. So I am eagerly anticipating that, even though we have next to no information about it.
Yeah. Equally hilarious, the new Aliens television show.
Oh, yeah.
Alien television show.
Yeah, Alien. So it follows Alien, a xenomorph who's in New York City as a stand-up comedian. He has a wacky neighbor named Kramer. And there's Elaine. And No, this is a series that Noah Hawley has been working on for FX. And it's going to take place on Earth. So a very different approach to what we see in the Alien films, which are almost always taking place in like a spaceship or a deserted lunar colony, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Fargo and Legion are both a little bit surreal. And if they can lean a bit more on that surrealness in this television show, as opposed to the last Alien movie, I think I've talked about this plenty of times before on this podcast, just the further into the Alien franchise we get, the more gruesome it gets, to the point where I couldn't even watch the most recent movie. But hopefully this TV show will pull back a little bit on the gruesome, because they're really focusing on, it seems like, Weyland Yutani, who is the evil corporation that's trying to weaponize the xenomorphs.
Yes. This is the company that, first of all, was in charge of sending the Nostromo out in the first place. And then in Aliens, it really turns into like the evil company, right? Because it becomes clear that that's when they are really actively trying to go after the alien without actually revealing to the rest of the human population that there are these xenomorphs. Like, the idea being like, there's this incredibly dangerous thing. We want it, but we don't want anyone to know that we know about it. So we're just going to send people out there and hope for the best. And then when they die, we'll send more of them.
Yeah. So I don't think I'm looking forward to this as much as I am to the next Taika Waititi, Jermaine Clements show.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting is that we talked about Blade Runner, and then we're talking about Alien. Obviously, both of those franchises or whatever have as part of the story the giant corporations that are amoral, right? They're not necessarily evil, but they're amoral, so they don't have any consideration for ethics or morality. And I mean, it's a pretty common theme in a lot of science fiction.
Yeah.
But I just feel like, wow, it's interesting that this keeps coming up. It's also in the same climate, obviously, as one where more and more people are questioning why we have billionaires and why we allow them to continue to accumulate enormous amounts of wealth. I think it shows the certain types of concerns that rise to the top, right? That's when we start to see it reflected in science fiction. And it just feels like that's part of we're coming back into that kind of cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And I look forward to that, 'cause that'll be a nice balance with just straight up monster show, monster, scary monster show. I like Alien. I like Aliens. I will definitely give this a shot. We'll see how far I get into it.
Yeah. And then for our last couple of stories, we're going to turn over to the Star Wars, as we were talking about before.
Star Wars.
We got to see a kind of teaser for the Star Wars anime series that's coming out, where this was a pretty phenomenal thing where Disney essentially has partnered with all these different anime studios. And from what I understand, gave these studios like carte blanche to do whatever they want with the Star Wars, you know, mythology, and to kind of realize it in their own styles. So we're getting like true anime renditions of Star Wars iconography and ideas. And it's not going to be canon. It's not like it's going to be incorporated into the Star Wars canon. But at the same time, it sounds to me like there were very few restrictions placed, which is phenomenal when you're talking about something with IP as famous as Star Wars.
Yeah, I think it's such a smart decision, too, because like everybody knows about, you know, the main Star Wars movies, the main 6 to 9, mm-hmm. 3 to 9.
yes, depending on how grouchy you are.
Depending on how grouchy you are, Jonathan.
Yeah.
But
sometimes I just go with 2.5, but okay.
2.5. Fine. I'll accept that. But there's such a rich world in the comics and the book series around Star Wars that I think it's really smart to explore some of that, give some of those characters and ideas and civilizations and such some more thought and some more spotlighting. Because even though this isn't necessarily going to be canon, let's say Tatooine Rhapsody really takes off and everybody loves it, there's nothing saying they can't expand on that as one of their future stories. Mm-hmm. Now that we're done with the Skywalkers, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, and also it's interesting because it's, again, I'm talking a lot about cycles in this episode, but this comes full circle in that Star Wars is a series that was in part inspired by the work of Kurosawa, for example. And so now we're seeing this science fiction fantasy series that has as part of its genetic heritage, this cinematic history from Japan. And now we're seeing a modern Japanese take on the Star Wars mythology. So it's not like it's out of place. Like it feels like it's coming home in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I will say the interesting thing to me, like the most interesting thing, is when they initially announced Visions, I was expecting something like Memories or The Animatrix that had super diverse art styles, which is not necessarily a good or a bad thing. That's just what I was picturing. It looks like a lot of these are a lot more mainstream anime styles. It doesn't make me any less excited for it.
A couple of them do look a little more stylized or a little more cartoony than others. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But like I said, that's not like a negative or a positive. It's just, it's something interesting that they announced this thing and my brain immediately went to this like super art house style of anthology. And instead it's you know, a little bit more mainstream, which I think is good to bring people into it who maybe wouldn't normally watch anime or a Star Wars cartoon, one of the other properties that's already out there.
Yeah. So this will be coming to Disney Plus later, and I look forward to seeing it. And then our last story is, what if you were, you know, a famous director and you really wanted to make a Star Wars movie and they told you no, so you decided to go and make a not Star Wars movie that's kind of a Star Wars movie, but it's not a Star Wars movie. and also was, again, kind of inspired by Kurosawa. Well, then that would mean you are Zack Snyder.
Yes. So apparently years ago, he wrote a mature Star Wars movie and Lucasfilm said, no, thank you. Or something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing. And now he's making a movie inspired by Star Wars and Akira Kurosawa for Netflix, which, you know, Netflix is really good at banking on popular properties. So it's not a bad thing. Some people really like that and they've come out with some very good stuff because of that. But he's going to be making a movie for them that is called Rebel Moon.
Yes. Can I read that little quick description that was in the AV Club article?
You certainly can. Okay,
this is a short one. And by the way, that AV, we'll have a link to the article in our show notes, but that AV Club article,
it's a little bit salty.
Oh, I love it. I love it so much. But here's the little description, because it made me immediately think of a different movie besides Star Wars, which is, the story is set in motion when a peaceful colony on the edge of the galaxy is threatened by the armies of a tyrannical regent named Balisarius. Totally not Palpatine. Desperate people dispatch a young woman with a mysterious past to seek out warriors from neighboring planets to help them make a stand. Ariel, does this remind you of any other, like, really super cheesy 1980s era science fiction film that we actually covered in a video episode of Large Neutron Collider years ago?
You mean Battle Beyond the Stars?
Exactly. It is Battle Beyond. This is Battle Beyond the Stars. If this Rebel Moon movie, which I get, is supposed to be like a grim, mature take on the sort of stuff you would have seen in Star Wars, but it's totally not Star Wars. Don't think it's Star Wars, y'all. It's not Star Wars. But if there are not like twins that are eating hot dogs and a space cowboy and a Valkyrie wearing almost no costume whatsoever, I am going to be really disappointed in this movie.
You know, I am interested to see what blaster bolts and lightsabers look like in grayscale. But for sepia tone.
Ooh, shots fired at Zack Snyder's palette choice.
It's okay. I'm just, you know, I'm like a stormtrooper. I always miss. So it's fine. But it's being written. He's co-writing it with Shay Hatton, who did Army of the Dead, and Kurt Johnson, who did 300. Which were some of the things that I liked better from him.
Okay. Fair enough.
Zack Snyder is all about the visuals, and I feel like space and sci-fi is a great place to put in pretty visuals. So maybe it'll be awesome.
I'm sure it's going to look great. I also feel like there will be absolutely no humanity in it, but I feel like that because Zack Snyder has time and time again created. Like I have often mentioned that I feel like Zack Snyder movies feel more like a kid playing with action figures and smashing them together than it does actual characters with like feelings and stuff. Zack Snyder doesn't typically do feelings. He does like iconic characters that, again, smash each other as hard as they possibly can for as long as they possibly can.
I mean, he does some feelings, but they're usually very everybody's faulty.
Yeah. Well, I could just say two words and just set you off. I could just say sucker punch and we could just see you go, but
there were feelings in that. Mine just didn't match up with the movies. Well, I don't want to pan Zack Snyder too hard. There are some things I think are very cool about his directing and art style.
I definitely
needs an editor.
I feel like Zack Snyder falls into a category, not that their styles are similar, but he falls into a category that reminds me of people like Michael Bay. And these are directors who can create really captivating visuals and really interesting action sequences. But I feel like everything around it doesn't work for me, or just doesn't hold very much humanity, or like there's nothing for me to connect to emotionally. So
there's, it's, at least it's a side of humanity that's not as pleasant to connect to.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of putting it. So anyway, while I'm slagging off on Zack Snyder, I'm not nearly doing it to the level that the AV Club did. And to be fair, like maybe this will come out and I will completely eat my words and I'll say like, wow, this was just a truly phenomenal piece of science fiction. So I don't want to pass judgment on something before it comes out. That's totally not fair. And, you know, you can't judge everything based upon the stuff that came before it. You could always be surprised.
Yeah. Well, how about we look at some stuff that has come out in the past that we both really do like right after this break?
We're going to start off this discussion with, you know, a little bit of sad news first, which is that over the last week, since our last episode, famed movie director Richard Donner passed away. He had lived a very full and long life. He was 91 when he passed away. He had not directed a film since 2006. So it had been a while since he had actually directed a movie, but he was involved in a lot of works and films and stuff over the years, and also series, some of which he would be removed from. But
yes,
yeah, we wanted to chat a bit about some of his work and the impact that it's had on us.
Well, first I want to say that one of his works is Lethal Weapon. And the only reason I'm saying that is because you said he hadn't directed anything in years. He had plans to come back to the Lethal Weapon franchise last year, and then pandemic. So he was actually going to jump back in recently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sad he didn't. I really like the Lethal Weapon franchise.
But when you look at some of the movies that he directed, it's interesting because they span a lot of different genres, right? So like one of my favorite films came out in 1978, the Superman movie with, you know, Christopher Reeve in it, and Richard Donner directed that. He also directed, or he started to direct Superman 2, and then there was a whole studio issue that he got removed from that film, but he did Superman, and Superman is such an earnest and corny movie. Like, if you go and watch that original Superman film, well, I say original, that 1978 Superman film, it is cornball. It is incredibly sincere, but to me, that's what makes it work. Like, Superman is a difficult character to make interesting because he's kind of flawless. It's sort of like Captain America. It's a character who doesn't really have any flaws, so it makes it hard to make an interesting film about them. But when you go with that sort of corny and earnest approach, it just becomes very charming. And you know, I mean, Reeves was amazing as Superman. You had Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor. You know, it was an engaging movie. And of course you had the John Williams score, which really brought it all together.
Yeah.
That to me is one of those iconic films that inspired within me a love of genre storytelling and films.
I mean, it's one of the first superhero movies I remember ever watching. And you're right. It was very earnest and sincere, and it balanced the humor with the romance so very well that as a child I loved it. And then going back and watching it as an adult, even though it is a little cornball, as you said, and even though some of the effects don't necessarily stand up, it holds up for me.
It has one of the
it is so touching.
It has one of the best visual gags of a Superman movie ever, where Clark Kent needs to change into Superman, and the famous image is Clark Kent jumping into a phone booth and changing from Clark Kent to Superman and then coming out of the phone booth as Superman. But he comes by not a phone booth, but like, so back in the day, we used to have these public telephones that were on like stands that were in like had little dividers up, but it wasn't a full booth. Right. And he just stops and gives it a quick like double take as he looks it up and down and realizes, like, no, that's not going to work. And then he moves on to find a place where he can change. It's just such a, I mean, obviously I'm describing a visual gag, which is the dumbest thing you can do. It's like reading out a comic strip, but it's one of those moments that just works. He also directed one of the few fantasy films from the 1980s that I thought really worked, which is Lady Hawk.
Are you talking about? Oh, okay. I was thinking you're going to talk about like Goonies or Scrooged. Well, but Lady Hawk was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't think of Goonies or Scrooged as a either of those as fantasy movies. Lady Hawk was definitely a fantasy film. Matthew Broderick, Rutger Hauer, Michelle Pfeiffer, really an interesting fantasy movie that I saw in the theater when I was a kid. Like I went to that movie when it opened up, and I think it still holds up. It's still, it's a really interesting fantasy love story. And even though Matthew Broderick has one of those accents that kind of sort of hovers around English and then goes away, even though there's that, it's really an engaging movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, plus you have a love for anything like medieval Renaissance-y story-wise.
Yes. So. And Rutger Hauer, man, he's just amazing. Yeah. And, you know, here was Rutger Hauer playing a heroic character. He's a heroic character with an edge because he's damaged. He's an emotionally damaged character. But this was sort of like, if you look at him in Blade Runner, where he's a damaged character who's an antagonist, here he was a damaged character who's a protagonist. It's almost like two sides of the same coin, and it's a great performance.
Do you want me to make you really sad, Jonathan?
Sure.
Okay, so Rutger Hauer, even though I've seen Blade Runner, and I think I saw it before what I'm about to mention, the first thing I remember knowing him from and recognizing him and going, oh, who is that? Oh, his name is Rutger Hauer, was 10th Kingdom. The 2000s really long miniseries
with
by
John Larroquette.
And Ed O'Neill, is that his name?
Oh yeah.
Al Bundy.
He played the troll, I think.
Yeah, he played the lead troll daddy. Which just sounds wrong to say, Ariel. Why did you say it that way?
I mean, that's gonna be we're gonna clip that. That's gonna be troll daddy.
Troll daddy. Which I actually really enjoyed that miniseries, but that's the first thing I remember recognizing Rutger Hauer in.
Yeah.
So,
well, Lady Hawk is one of those films that if you have never seen it, you should check it out. It is, now granted, it's from the 80s. The effects are very dated. The music is bizarre. Like it's very new agey with lots of synthesizers. It definitely is a product of its time, but it again was one of those fantasy films from the 80s that I thought actually worked. There were only a handful of fantasy movies that came across as anything more than just like super cheap sets. And like most of the 80s fantasy films were like B movies. This was not. He also did The Goonies, like you pointed out, a movie that's very divisive now.
Yes. It's you either watched it as a kid and loved it, or you don't now.
did you hear about what he and his wife did for the actor who played Chunk?
I didn't know.
So Chunk was the chubby kid, right? In The Goonies, who was made to do the truffle shuffle and all that kind of stuff. So, when he was getting older, like he wasn't able to get more roles really after a little while. And so he was deciding he was going to go to college, and he asked, Richard Donner if Richard would be willing to write a letter of recommendation when he was applying to school. And, Donner said, yeah, kid, let's have a meeting and we'll talk about what you want me to say. And they had a meeting. And the actor told Donner all about his background and the struggles he had and all this kind of stuff. Donner and his wife paid for his tuition for him to go to college. He ended up becoming an entertainment lawyer.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a really sweet story.
It is. And, you know, like, I know that there are some problematic things in Goonies. It, like, you know, Chunk kind of being pigeonholed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's, no, oh, yeah, there's
Lawrence Cohen.
There's
his name is not Chunk.
There's tons of problematic stuff in Goonies. Like, you have the Data character is, that's an issue, right? Like, there's a, again, it was a product of its time. Not to excuse it, but rather to say, like, to give it, contextualize it, to say, like, this was an era where that level of care and thought and empathy just did not exist in Hollywood. And that was a bad thing. So that's something to keep in mind.
You know, but he went from Superman and Goonies to Lethal Weapon, as I mentioned earlier, and Scrooged. But he also did some horror, which I didn't know. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't aware that he worked on Tales from the Crypt, which gave me nightmares as a child. And I have never seen The Omen. So
yeah, The Omen. Yeah, that's one of those, you know, creepy kid movies. Definitely one of those that is worth checking out. He was going to be a producer on a sequel to The Goonies, which I have no idea if that is even still a thing that's going to happen. He also, you know, has worked in some regard with lots of other elements that people would recognize. And like, he lived to be 91. So it's not that his departure was a shock or anything along those lines, but more that it really allowed us a chance to reflect on his body of work and kind of appreciate sort of the things that he did.
Yeah, because he was so varied in the stories that he put out and the styles that he put out. And just, he made stories that, regardless of whether they're for their era or their time, they last. Like, people still know about The Goonies. People still know about Lethal Weapon. Mm-hmm. People still know about Scrooged and Superman. So, you know, there are certain movies that just get made and they're impressive for a while and then people forget about them. But his works have endured, and that's really impressive.
It is. And, you know, we salute you, Richard Donner. You know, Godspeed, Fair Winds and Following Seas and all that. And thank you for the work you did, because there's some really cool stuff. I mean, if nothing else, we got Cyndi Lauper's The Goonies Are Good Enough music video, which is truly brilliant. I mean, you know, you bring in professional wrestlers to pretend like they're actors and chase Cyndi Lauper around, you're guaranteed to have a masterpiece.
I feel like you're biased there.
I might be. I also genuinely love that song.
I mean, it is a fun song, but if you put, like, I could put professional wrestlers into Sucker Punch, you'd probably like it. So,
okay, let's not throw hands here. Okay, we're gonna take a break. When we come back, we're going to mash up two things that never, ever, ever should be mashed up together, and find out what happens.
So things that should never, ever be mashed up together, but we do. That has been our theme for the past few weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, like, mashups are a lot more fun if you take two things that are very much unrelated and try to make them work, as opposed to, oh, let's take these two things that are similar and make them, you know, mash them up together. Well, I mean, if they're similar, then you just end up with Zack Snyder's version of not a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, yeah. So this time we're taking a couple of our news stories. We're actually staying true to our news stories, and we are mashing up aliens, something from the Alien universe.
Yes, and something from the Star Wars universe.
Yes, the best thing from the Star Wars universe, is Ewoks. And now that I'm thinking about it, I would have been an Ewok. I would have been Wicket Yub Nub.
Now, I specifically had mentioned to Ariel when we were figuring out what we were going to mash up, I said the Ewok movie. So for those of you out there who...
But there are two of them.
There are two of them. The second one is it starts in a way that completely invalidates the entirety of the first one. Mm-hmm. So for those who are blissfully unaware that there were two Ewok movies, in the mid-80s, after Return of the Jedi came out, and obviously the Ewoks were a boon for toy sales. Like that was, I mean, by that time, Star Wars had become a true merchandise machine. It wasn't that way with the first movie, at least not originally. But once that started rolling, man, did Lucas ride that, right? So
yeah.
Ewoks were a big hit. So they decided to make a couple of what were made for TV movies here in the United States. They did get apparently a limited theatrical release in other parts of the world. And the first one involved a family that gets, I think, stranded on Endor, and they end up encountering the Ewoks, and they are trying to survive various dangers in that. The second one starts off with everyone in that family, with the exception of the little girl, getting slaughtered. So the family that you were following and rooting for in the first movie gets almost completely wiped out in the second one, the beginning of the second one. But anyway, it was really more of an excuse to have more Ewoks so that you could have more toys.
Yeah. I mean, the girl did stick. Sindel was in both of them. And we already kind of talked about aliens. You know, there's these like primordial parasitic monsters, aliens doing what they do. And there's an evil corporation that tries to weaponize them. And then they run amok because they're really powerful and have survived since the dawn of time and spaceships. And it's really scary. The first movie is a horror. The second movie is kind of a sci-fi adventure, but also scary. And then it goes downhill from there.
Yes, I agree. Like the first two films are masterpieces, and they are so different. Right. The first one is this very atmospheric, oppressive, scary horror movie by Ridley Scott. The second one still has some scary elements, but is more of an action movie. Like, and it's that one's by James Cameron. So it's interesting that they can be so different, and yet they feel like they belong in the same universe. It's just different stories and different settings.
Yeah. And something we forgot to mention earlier, but AI also plays kind of a possibly villainous role in the stories as well, but it's so overshadowed for me by the actual aliens and that creepy grotesqueness.
Because the androids in the Alien series, they're made by the corporation that's sending people out. So whenever there's an android, you immediately question that android's motivations, right? You immediately assume this android is specifically there to fulfill the mission for the corporation, whether that ends up slaughtering everybody else or not.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that being said, let's take these furry little creatures and match them up with some evil slimy aliens.
Sounds good.
I'm going to go ahead and go first.
Okay.
So this is called Ewoks and the Battle for Nostromo.
Okay.
So, after Sindel's ship crashes on Endor, she and her brother befriend a bunch of Ewoks in an attempt to find their parents, who are missing after the crash. The kids are told that their parents were captured by that Feech Lurdo, the Gorax. They make a plan to travel to the Gorax's lair to free them. Feech Lurdo, by the way, is Ewokese, it just means that darn bad guy, kind of, essentially. Anyhow, they make a plan to travel to the Gorax's lair to free them, but when they get to the lair, they find something much worse than the Gorax. They find 100 egg-like slimy objects, and the Gorax lying in the corner with his chest burst open. Then they see a scorch trail that looks like a small ship had taken off from the Gorax's lair. The children and the Ewoks decide to quickly leave the lair and come up with another plan, but just as they do, they are caught by a sorceress named Cheryl. She is trying to leave the planet as well, in fear after something horrible happened at her Marauder's castle to her companion, and she figured the children and Ewoks would be a good bargaining tool onto any ship she found out in space. So she throws them all into a spaceship and flies off, and in space they find a spaceship, of course, the Nostromo. It seems to be abandoned, so maybe she didn't need her prisoners after all, and she completely forgets about them when she lands in the hangar bay and there is a shadow and a chitter that she goes off to find what it is. That leaves the kids and their Ewok friends alone in the landing bay. They see an escape pod that they assumed would leave similar scorch marks to the one they saw on Endor, the moon that they were on where the Ewoks live, And they decide Sindel and her brother's parents might be there, and they go searching for them. All along the way, they hear chittering screams and see remains of what looks like it might have once been sentient creatures. Also a lot more slimy eggs, lots of them. And then there is a different scream. They go cautiously to see what it is and find Cheryl ripped apart from the stomach like something burst through, just like the Gorax. The Ewoks grab whatever improvised weapons they can, pipes for spears, knives, shrapnel, and even a Wayland Yutani flamethrower, and continue their search. As they round a corner, Sindel and her brother see their parents asleep in a couple of cryo chambers, or what we would assume would be cryo chambers, they don't really know. As the kids struggle to free their parents, they hear a chittering screech behind them, and that's when they see it, the queen of the xenomorphs. She opens her huge maw, and then her smaller maw at the Ewoks, and they all yell, "Kill the monster," in Ewokese, and before the xenomorph can cause their carnage, the Ewoks dispatch her, because Ewoks are really vicious, you all. Feeling momentarily safe, the kids figure out how to get their parents out of stasis. The parents tell the kids they were taken by the queen xenomorph to the ship they thought they were done for with how quickly she dispatched the Gorax, but then she stuck them in stasis. Thankfully, the kids, the Ewoks, and the parents all find their way back to the escape pod without further harrowing adventures, and they head back to Endor. As they land, the parents look a bit odd. Sindel asks what's wrong, and they say, "Oh, nothing, just some indigestion." As they all leave the ship with one Ewok, who we all know is Wicket, shooting his newfound flamethrower in the air and screaming yum-nub as they head back to the Ewok village to celebrate and repair their own ship, the camera zooms in on the loading dock of the escape pod. We see an egg, tucked away in a hidden corner, begin to shake, and we hear a chittering screech. Cut to black.
Wow. Darker than you usually go.
Darker than I usually go. I won't say it was good, but...
Well, no, I think it was interesting, an interesting take, because you made it where the Ewoks were characters. It's a little different in my version. This is called Aliens Ewok and Roll. Here we go. Ellen Ripley has a problem. After being rescued by a salvage crew and awakened out of stasis, she has discovered that the wicked Wayland Yutani Corporation has established a colony on the very same moon where her crew encountered the eggs of the dangerous alien creature. The same creature that managed to kill all aboard the Nostromo, except for Ripley herself. And her kitty cat, Jonesy. And now, the company has lost contact with that colony, necessitating a reconnaissance mission to find out what happened. Ripley agrees to go along as a sort of consultant. Ripley joins the crew of the Sulaco. Most of the crew are Marines, and they're skeptical of Ripley's accounts of a dangerous alien. And then there's Carter Burke, a rep from the company. Oh, and of course, there's the ship's protocol android, Bishop 3PO. The Sulaco sets course for the moon, now known by the colony name of Endor. The Sulaco deploys a dropship down to the surface of Endor, where the crew finds the small colony completely empty except for one young girl they decide to call Newt Skywalker. Newt is clearly shaken up and almost completely non-communicative. The crew pick up signals of the colonists. They appear to be up in the trees. And so, after using some equipment to climb up, the crew find a primitive village up in the trees itself. The colonists are all comatose, and they're covered in this weird goo. Ripley tries to warn the others, but while doing so, something terrible happens. One of the comatose colonists begins to shudder, and their abdomen distends horrifically. Next thing you know, a little teddy bear-like critter pops out of the colonist's torso. "Oh, how cute," says Corporal Hicks. "Are you crazy?" asks Ripley. "We're going to be rich," yells Burke. "The merchandising alone is going to go through the roof." Before Ripley can respond, the little teddy bear critter leaps out and latches on to another crew member. Let's say it was Lieutenant Gorman. And the teddy bear viciously bites into Gorman's neck, killing him. At this point, Corporal Hicks kinda loses it. He will continue to kinda lose it throughout the rest of the movie. The group makes their escape as other furry alien critters burst out of colonists. They manage to get out of the trees and back to the dropship, but they find that the ship itself has been disabled as two adult aliens, who look like teddy bears but bigger and armed with primitive weapons, have managed to damage the flight systems of the ship and kill the pilots. Oh, and the adult Ewok aliens also have second tinier Ewok alien heads in their own mouths when they open up their mouths, which is an image so horrific I hate that I wrote it down. Having no choice but to hide in the remains of the colony, the group bunkers down, and that's when they hear it. Hundreds of aliens, all chanting, "Yub Nub! Yub Nub!" "Game over, man! Game over!" says Corporal Hicks, who continues to kinda lose it. Ripley takes over. Burke secretly tries to capture a little teddy bear alien, but he gets his face eaten off by a bunch of them in a way that is brutal and yet satisfying, because Burke rhymes with jerk. What follows is a sequence of big action set pieces in which the Marines get taken out by Ewok aliens who use the terrain and primitive traps to their advantage. Ripley, Newt, Hicks, and Bishop manage to evade capture and death, but the others aren't so lucky, though Vasquez does get this really cool sacrifice move that buys them some time and squishes a few Ewoks. Bishop offers to make his way to the communications station on the colony, where he'll be able to make contact with the Sulaco in orbit and deploy another dropship, so he leaves the group behind. They have a few more close calls as furry Ewoks try to take him out, but fortunately the Ewoks have short little legs, so they're not really that hard to outrun. But Bishop eventually returns, having managed to land the dropship, but more importantly, he's discovered something odd. The Ewoks worship Bishop 3PO as a god. That's a pretty big promotion to go from Bishop to God. With this newfound status, Bishop is able to convince the Ewoks to allow Hicks, Ripley, and Newt Skywalker to go to the dropship. He joins them there, and all four make their way back to the Sulaco. Once there, Ripley turns to Bishop. "Nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure." Bishop nods and aims the Sulaco's nuclear arsenal at the surface of Endor, where you can almost hear the sounds of musical celebration. And boom, a huge wave of nuclear missiles rains down on the moon and just wipes everything out. Ripley, Hicks, Newt Skywalker, and Bishop all enter cryosleep as the ship sets a course back to core space. The end.
That was really good.
Yeah.
Even though you killed all of my favorite Ewoks.
Well, I mean, like, they were monsters in this one.
They were. I mean, I think that's the thing that we can agree about in our both of our mashups is that the Ewoks are vicious, vicious creatures.
I mean, they in Return of the Jedi, they capture our heroes, and it's clear they're going to eat them. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they turn stormtrooper helmets into a giant xylophone.
Which is awesome and hilarious.
And then they change their end song from one version of Return of the Jedi to the remastered version of Return of the Jedi.
Do they?
Oh, yeah.
They took out Yub Nub.
Yeah, that's it. The song's different at the end, right? Like it was a little Ewok song. Yub Nub. Yeah, Yub Nub. Yub da 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 da. That's totally different in the special edition. Yeah.
Well, that's okay because when we got the cartoon, they spoke English. So.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean,
and I guess somewhat in the movies.
Listen, they had already had the experience of the Star Wars Christmas special and realized what a huge mistake it was to have Wookiees only speaking in Wookiees for the entire special. That just made it incomprehensible. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of Large Neutron Collider. We ran a little long this time. We're going to close it off. And as always, if you have stuff you want to share with us, let's say you've got your own mashup of aliens and Ewoks that you want to share, or maybe you have a suggestion for a mashup we should do, or some conversation topic you would like us to explore in the geek space, reach out to us. You can do so by sending us an email. That's lnc@iheartmedia.com. Or you can reach out on the various social platforms. Ariel, what are they?
On Twitter, they are LNC_podcast, and on Instagram and Facebook, they are Large Nerdron Collider. Also, if you like us, or even just tolerate us, leave us a nice review on your podcatching system, tell your friends, and share our episodes. We would love to chat with more of you.
And until next time, I am Jonathan Yub Nub Strickland.
And I am Ariel Fuzzyface Caston. The Large Neutron Collider is a production of iHeartRadio and was created by Ariel Kasten. Jonathan Strickland is the executive producer. The show is produced, edited, and published by Tari Harrison. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.